You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hey, you ready?
It's a little more gangster-like, more in keeping with my company.
Are you ready? Oh. Is you ready?
Ready.
You say you ready?
Oh.
Whole squad ready?
Ready.
Is you ready?
Huh?
Are you ready?
Ready.
Is you ready? Whole squad ready. We came here to see Jet. What you got? No, no, no. Not on my watch.
No way.
Bring what you got. I'm going to the top. You can bring what you got. I'm going to the top. Bring what you got. Bring what you got. I'm going to the top. I'm going to the top.
Are you ready? You know what time it is, right? They don't want us to make it. So it's time to take it. Rhyme with them killers, the time to see who be real unloaded.
The group is called Migos, in case you're wondering. And joining me from Kansas is the first topic of our conversation today, Will Costantini. Will, how you doing?
I'm ready.
Is you ready? Yeah. Joining me from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. Timmy, what's up?
Not much, Matt. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, nice to have you as always. And joining me from right down the road in San Clemente, a guy I had lunch with on Friday, Jeff Kenny. What's going
good,
on there?
Max, thanks.
From the Nutmeg State, Jeff Kenny.
Yeah.
There you have it.
Everything's good with me and mine, but yeah, everything's fine as usual.
All right. That's a nice lie. We have to talk about Will. Will, tell us about your COVID, your self-COVID diagnosis, and the test you've administered to yourself to confirm the diagnosis.
Yeah, so I had a little bit of a cold last week, and then I realized on Wednesday that I couldn't taste or smell anything.
How did you realize that?
I was eating, breakfast. And so I make oatmeal, and I put some walnuts and some blueberries and some honey in there. And I said, gee, I must have forgot the honey. It doesn't taste sweet. And then I said, no, I know I put it. And then I said, it doesn't taste like anything. really bizarre. And then, so to confirm, that night I ordered in some Thai soup, and normally I have it like mild to medium. This time I got a medium to hot. And,
what was the rationale? What was the rationale behind the medium to hot in your medical mind?
I wanted to really push my taste buds.
Got it. Right.
Just to see if there was anything there. And so it burned my mouth, but I couldn't taste it. So I tried to get a COVID test. And I actually couldn't get one. And I finally got a test scheduled for Monday at 11:30. So
wait a minute. So explain the process of getting a COVID test. What did you do? We have drive-through things all over the place. One by the fairgrounds, real close to me. What'd you have to do to go get a test?
I know. So you go on Google up COVID test, and it brings up about 80,000 different advertisements.
Right.
And I think you cycle that a little bit, and like you get on the CVS website, and they ask you what your symptoms are, and then they direct you to all the local CVS drugstores. And then you get on that drugstore, and it says there's no test available today. And so then you go on Walgreens. And then there's some other organization doing testing, and you can't get it, and you got to have an appointment, so you can't get it today. And then you jack around for a while and finally find one on Monday that you can get. This is on Friday when you're screwing around with it. Got or maybe it. On Saturday, I forget. Yeah, so I've been sort of doing the self-quarantine, not knowing if I got it or not. And yeah, that's about it. I had a cold on Tuesday, Wednesday, a little bit of Thursday, but nothing Friday, Saturday, nothing at all. But I still can't taste or smell. so I figure I need to get a test.
Have you read? How long does your taste vanish for people that have that happen?
A week or 2 weeks or a couple of months or forever.
Oh, well.
You know, a lot of people, it's like a couple of weeks.
Got it. That's what we're banking on. Losing your sense of taste, like, that would suck.
It's horrible, particularly when you're sitting at home by yourself.
You don't
even look forward to having dinner.
Will, can you get it and still, I mean, can you get coronavirus and yet still have your, like, that not be one of the symptoms?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a wide, I think they list about 10 symptoms, and I only had two of them. I had upper respiratory congestion and loss of taste and smell. And there's all kinds of other symptoms, but those are the only two I had. And I'm sure that there are people that don't have that as a symptom.
Right.
And that's also a symptom for common cold, upper respiratory congestion and loss of taste and smell. Because common cold is just a different virus. And then, of course, you know, you want to drive yourself crazy. Go on YouTube and Google up loss of taste and smell, and you'll get people from, you know, Indonesia to Antarctica to Norway explaining everything about it.
So yeah, what did you learn? There's no home remedy for like gargle with gasoline for a couple minutes and you're good.
Scrub them with
bleach and they'll go away.
Yeah, the home remedies are how to recover, and you I don't know, get like strong smells and retrain your brain and whatever. I'm not there yet. If I'm gonna live with this for a long time, I gotta spread out how I'm gonna attack it. So
got it. Yes, Jeffrey.
Hey, Mac, did you get a test yet?
What for?
You said you were saying there's some up around where you are. Did you get one or do you not?
No, I just walk my dogs and I see them out there every day.
Really? Because I'm going to Pennsylvania on Wednesday, and they're starting to go crazy over there. So I'm trying to get a test, I think, in the next couple of days, just to
they have a big drive-through thing at the Orange County Fairgrounds.
Yeah, the thing is, there's two kinds of tests. Apparently, one test you get fairly rapid results, and one test goes to the lab.
Oh, we don't.
And that takes at least 2 days to get the results back.
Then there's two like other you go, types of tests. There's two other you know, types, though. There's
cough the paper, and they tell you test. Got it.
Wait, hold on. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
There's two other types of tests, though. There's the free test and the one you have to pay for. So I'm not going to put myself out of any kind of financial distress to go to Pennsylvania by paying for a test. So the free test is what I'm interested in. And I really don't, like, – it just says, like Will was saying, you know,
yeah, that comes back in 6 months. So you might want to reconsider that.
I'm ready for it. The gift that keeps on giving.
So, Will, one, can you still play online poker? And two, does your loss of taste impact your ability to play? And how do you think you contracted this disease, virus type situation?
Well, I don't play online poker, but if I did, you
could.
Oh, but I don't.
Oh, you go in line? Oh, that's in line with your desire to intimidate everybody. Right.
So, how do I think I contracted it? I may have gotten it at a poker game.
I believe, you know, that's true.
They're in people's basements.
Yep.
They're not well ventilated.
No, look, I've watched it there.
I could have gotten it anywhere.
I've watched the poker games on ESPN as I channel surf, and it's not exactly going to get confused with like James Bond's game of what's he playing? Poker in Casino Royale. It's not.
Right.
There's not. We're not confusing those two events, all right?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Just thought so. All right. Any. And so you don't play online poker, so it doesn't impact that ability. Gotcha. Might you consider it now that you're in quarantine? I mean, keep your skills up, bro. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's. I'm sure there's.
I actually like the interpersonal interaction of the live game.
Timmy, as Timmy said, you know, there's probably retirees on there. They're looking to get their retirement ripped off, and you might have an opportunity there. Just saying, as long as you're a lot of time on your hands. All right. Any other questions for Will relative to his diagnosis? None? Doc Lynch? You're the medical professional here.
Hey, Doc Lynch is so tired of this whole conversation. It's appalling to me what's being said about the Thanksgiving holidays and this this third wave, and I have no comment. You know what, my stepmom's brother-in-law, who's got every comorbidity in the world and is 85 years old, came down with COVID, showed up with bilateral pneumonia at the hospital, and he's fine. He's fine in 5 days. I'm just tired of listening to anything about COVID.
So you're kind of apathetic to Will's medical situation as a medical professional?
As a medical professional, I would only say to Will that he should reach out and not spend too much time immersed in the fantasy land of online poker or any kind of role playing games that I understand from Jeff.
That you can, participate.
It's been plaguing you. So I would seek out while you're in quarantine some type of communication with a living human being, and no avatars or gambling things. That would be my only recommendation.
Gotcha. Jeffrey, you have any questions of Will about his medical condition?
Well, I was interested to know about if you can have your taste and smell and still have COVID. You know, so he cleared that one up. You can still have your taste and smell and be dead as a doornail from COVID. If you're 92 years old and you accidentally put a roofing nail through your skull, and you just happen to be positive for COVID, they would call that a COVID death.
So I have a question for you, Will. What happens if you are positive? So you just continue the quarantine and sit in your house and that's it?
Yeah, I figure if I'm positive, then I'll wait for another week and get another test, and I'll probably get the results sent to my doctor.
How many negative tests you need, and what time frame to participate in in-person poker in the greater Kansas City area? Okay.
If I'm negative,
you're there.
I'm not worried about it, right? It means I just got a cold,
right? If you're negative,
if I'm positive though.
Oh, okay.
If I'm positive, I got to wait probably a week and get another test. I'll let my doctor know that I got it, and as long as I don't get any other symptoms or any damn thing I can do about it.
Right. Gotcha. Jeffrey.
Don't they have like? You know how there's leper colonies and shit in the old days? Don't they have like COVID colonies where you can go and everybody's infected and you can, you know, hang out with them and, you know, do arm wrestling and, you know,
Jeffrey, yeah. No, they do not. Okay. Moneymaker.
I would submit to you.
One of us has to get COVID first. Will's on you.
I would submit to you that we're mere months away from having to provide proof of negativity or have taken a vaccine in order to travel. In other words, for Jeff to show up in Pennsylvania, he has to show that he's negative. I bet you money. We're just right around the corner from that. For a disease that 99.9% of us survive with no problem. It's bizarre.
Hawaii, too.
Hawaii.
Oh, I can't go. I can't go to Australia and visit my kids. That's a 2-week mandatory quarantine.
In theory,
traveling to New York State is a two-week mandatory quarantine as well.
That's absolutely.
Why do you say in theory?
Well, that's New York says that that's what you're supposed to do.
Are you
they say in Washington, D.C.?
Are you insinuating that people go to New York and don't do that?
some people still believe that we live in a free country.
And what does that mean? That's a little bit cryptic. Does that mean no, they don't?
We'll just leave it as neither can confirm nor deny.
Yes.
Think of it as sort of like nuclear weapons.
Yo, yes, I'm familiar with those.
Yeah.
If they were on board, we would have a problem. But since I can neither confirm nor deny their presence, it would be a surely hypothetical question. Okay. Let's see. Well, we have to start with Jeffrey because he has no intellectual moral courage other than to say, I agree with Will. I agree with Tim. So, Jeffrey, is there a current event from this past week that you would like to discuss?
Yes. Well, first I want to talk a little bit about my mood.
Your mood?
Yes, my mood. Even though I sound jocular and, you know, and funny and everything right now, well, attempting to be funny. Yeah. Truth is, I'm worried about our republic because I sense that I think that the president has a good case with this fraud stuff, all these things that happened simultaneously in these five states. But I feel that, like, our government agencies that are run supposedly by the executive branch are simply not going to they're going to ignore it, i.e. first and foremost, Justice Department and their underlings, the FBI, they're going to ignore this thing. And so what's going to happen is just like with the non-prosecution of Hillary, and just like the non-prosecution of even though Joe Biden's on television, you know, basically threatening the president of Ukraine about withholding monies if he doesn't fire a guy, even though and the president is innocent of all these things they threw up against them. I think finally these guys got together who run us, who run America, and just decided this guy's going, this is how we're going to do it, and everybody get on the right side of it. And everybody almost has, and that worries me.
Okay. Tim, comment?
Well, the Trump has got this big crack. No, Trump has got this big Kraken thing that his lawyers are going to unleash, and it has to be evidence that we can all see, that we can all understand, that everybody can get. That's undeniable. I don't think that they're going to be able to do that. I don't think that kind of evidence exists right now. They've got a lot of supposition and mathematical theories and a few whistleblowers. I don't think he's got enough to turn anything, and it's And I believe the dynamic that I said 2 weeks ago is playing out. That is, the Republicans got no interest in spending a whole lot of time taking fighting for Trump. Trump's not a Republican. It's in their best interest to let him go so they can reap the whirlwind of chaos that ensues. But it's pretty depressing because I do not believe I've heard anything that explains the enthusiasm gap between Trump and Biden. And I will never believe that this was a legitimately won contest. I mean, never. And so that's one more thing taken away from me. But Kennedy did it when I was a baby, so I should stop being a baby and maybe man up.
But you were just a baby, so it didn't really matter.
Yeah, I was just a baby. I didn't take it that personally. But now I take it personally. I can't stop thinking of 2009 and fucking Jeff sending all those guys out there to make sure that Karzai could rig the elections properly. I can't get past that. And now we come home to find 10 years later the same damn thing right here. It's annoying and a little bit disappointing.
I was the Governor Kemp of Nangarhar Province. I helped facilitate that crook being in power. That's for sure.
Yes. William, your thoughts on Jeffrey's topic?
Yeah, you know, I have purposely avoided riding up and down with the news on this thing at a very high level. You know, the hypocrisy just continues to come out there. Whether you believe that the president has a good case or not, you know, the Wall Street Journal today, yesterday's Wall Street Journal had a headline that, you know, words to the effect of, because Trump hasn't conceded, it puts the Biden transition in greater danger of hacking. So Trump continues to be everything wrong with the republic, although I don't know what he's really done. He's contesting election results through the legal process, which is set up. But that is the end of civilization as we know it. Whereas 4 years ago, the resistance was called out for the day after the election, in an election which no one had the remotest evidence that any fraud had occurred, pro-Trump fraud. So it shows you the army that the truth is up against. And it's a very wide and deep army. And that should give us great pause. You know, whether all of the things that seem like fraud to me still seem like fraud. I agree with Tim on the whole thing of the enthusiasm gap. I don't see people that are really excited about the Biden agenda for whatever that is to cause the greatest number of votes to be cast for a candidate in the history of the Republic. That stuff is all, you know, as Tim says, observable reality. All of our betters are telling us to shut up and color. And I sort of took the line long ago that this thing was going to get settled in the courts, not in public opinion. So I really haven't paid attention to a lot of the detail that's been going on in public.
Yeah, you know, I was waiting for the results of, you know, of the Georgia recount just to see, you know, what they would come up with. But the last week, I've been in the post-traumatic winning cone of silence, so I really don't – I haven't followed other than wave tops. And again, I share your concern. I stopped believing in coincidence in Iraq in 2004. But – you know, I saw a story. I didn't read it because I didn't have time. But I saw a story where Tucker Carlson told—is it Sidney Powell? If you've got evidence, let's see it. And so at some point, you have to shit or get off the pot. And I see. My thing was okay. There, you can't buy a round of ammunition in this country. You can't buy a weapon. So who's going to come out to vote? All the people that bought all the weapons, all the people that bought out all the ammunition, or the people that, you know, were protesting it, we all watched. And the nation in the election moved right of center. And so what are the footnotes that say, okay, yeah, but Biden, you know, Biden beats him, and, you know, I don't get it. And so, but at some point, somebody's got to produce some evidence. You know, that's how the shit works, and
you're right.
I'm waiting
you're
for
absolutely
it.
Absolutely right.
I'm waiting
you're
for
you're right
it.
About that, Mac. At some point, and it's called a trial. And now you can say, and they have said, for instance, in Michigan alone, there's over 250 signed affidavits where people sign on penalty of perjury that they witnessed outright voter different types of voter fraud, and many more in Pennsylvania and Georgia and Nevada and Arizona, you know, and Michigan and Wisconsin. And so, but Tucker Carlson never castigated. There's a Chinese girl he brings on the show all the time who all she does is give hearsay evidence about the fact that the Chinese government was behind sending the coronavirus this way on purpose.
Right.
What we were saying, we didn't really think happened. She says it did happen. He brings her on. He treats her with kid gloves.
Right.
And the whole time they were going after President Trump with the Mueller thing, every week you saw either on his show or you saw on Hannity, you saw this parade of lawyers. You know, some of them were actual reporters for Fox News. Some of them were guys like that McCarthy guy and Solomon and the guy who wrote the book about the Clinton corruption for their foundation. Never did anybody say, let us see, you know, the evidence. Never. All of a sudden, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on all these people to include Fox News so they right away castigate. These are not Justice Department lawyers. This thing has enough of it already. Just the films you see on TV, what went on in Philly, what went on in Pittsburgh, you know, what went on down there in Atlanta with people being blocked from witnessing the votes. That alone would be was more evidence, just those two, those three things was more evidence than the entire Mueller investigation. So it's obviously a double standard, and it's obvious that our government population largely has decided, you know, without us being consulted, that President Trump has is his time is done and we need to move on to this mumbling, stuttering, you know, senile old turd who at his best day was incompetent and a liar. You know, they want him instead. And so we just got to suck it. That pisses me off. And that makes me worried if they can do it.
Yeah, my sense is, though, Jeff, and my intellectual pushback is, you know, there are courts in this country that if you bring them that evidence that's compelling, that they would issue a stay or you would have your day in court. But it doesn't – I haven't seen anything that any national writer that's conservative would hang their hat on and say,
yeah,
this –
that's a good point.
This has the – this has the opportunity – you know, to change the outcome of the election. I haven't seen that, and that's what I've been looking for. But again, yeah. I haven't been paying attention last week.
Well, I understand that, and I appreciate it. But November 3rd and November 4th are the days that the crime is committed. It's now November 22nd. I mean, nobody, whether we're talking Al Capone, the Boston Strangler, you know, Richard Nixon, none of that evidence was presented, you know, that quick. This okay. thing just happened, and okay. it happened across the government agencies and across the country. So, you know, I mean, it's reasonable to expect they need to get time.
Got it.
They don't have a lot of resources. You know, it's not a million lawyers out there.
Okay. All right. Tim, final comment? Will, final comment?
Well, I think Tucker Carlson was going where a lot of the more conservative pundits are already at. I mean, guys like Powerline and Andrew Clavin who are saying – what I said earlier, which is I'd love to see some evidence, but I don't think you can put together a compelling case that quickly. In the past, we have had elections overturned months after they were called because of fraud, you know, and so these are congressmen, and I don't think any senators, but in Congress they have, and the guy's been replaced. I don't think we'll do that with a presidential election. I think we're screwed. I absolutely don't think it was an honest election, but I think we're screwed. And I just think that Tucker Carlson and a lot of other people have gone through the seven stages of grief, and we're already at the resignation stage, you know. Now it's just, to tell you the truth, I'm demoralized, flat out demoralized, but I don't know what the hell I can do about it.
Got it. Will, final comment?
No, that's it.
All right. Afghan Iraq slim down. Normally you see those in the run-up to the election in an attempt to be able to stand up and say, hey, I told you I would do this, and in fact, I have done it. This one comes after the election. Jeff, thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's about that time. I mean, you know, the amount of resources we're pumping in there is insignificant compared to, like, say, 2007, right? Or 2011 in Afghanistan's case.
Right.
But the amount of money we've spent and the amount of money we're still spending to prop up both security forces, both sets of security forces, is considerable. And there's no reason that they can't use the preponderance of technology, manpower, you know, that they have to successfully negotiate if they choose to with the op four in that, especially in Afghanistan. You know, now these guys, they're going to try and suck. People say the Afghans have a great history as warriors. Really what they got is a great history as criminals, you know, as extortionists. And they will try and squeeze every honest nickel they can out of the United States and then the United Nations and everybody until, you know, finally they, you know, but I think the quicker they're yanked off our tit, the faster they'll either run away, you know, the government there, or come to an accommodation. Probably that's how they usually do things, you know, with the Taliban. And I actually heard Haqqani say that, you know, yes, we're going to come in and we're going to give women the rights that they deserve under the Quran, which means it's the same rights as like a
you know, a dog deserves under, you know, under the Quran as far as the women's rights. But basically, the guy's trying to he's trying to politic. Right. Whereas before, they're all about just shooting people, murder. So that's you know, they have enough you know, largesse from us to where they can do it. And Iraq, forget about it, man. I mean, Jesus, you know, if the Iraqis can't handle it now, I mean, you know, we're better off not being attached to them.
Got it. All right, Tim, your thoughts?
Well, it's a great political move. I mean, it's not like Biden's going to come in and immediately put him right back. And I like it only because it kind of withdraws our footprint down, I'd hope, to where we've got to pull out of Nangarhar, and we've only got people sitting up in just in Kandahar and just in Bagram. I don't see how you can have a whole lot of other people out there, but we don't know about the allies. How many is if NATO's not having corresponding drawdowns, they might try to limp along and keep, you know, keep Nangarhar and Jalalabad going and those kind of places. And that's not, it's not going to,
yeah,
that's not going to work out.
That's what you're going to do.
Yeah, that's not going to work out well. I think they need to withdraw their footprint a lot and let this thing end the way it's going to end, which is not going to be pretty.
All right. And okay, Will, and then I want to go back around. And, you know, I think the last time we had moved from cautiously pessimistic to straight pessimistic, mm-hmm. and we can go around again. Will, your thoughts on the slimming down of American troops?
You know, first of all, who in the United States cares outside of people inside the Beltway? Nobody.
Nobody.
So we're going from 4,500 to 2,500 in Afghanistan. And, you know, the thing that proves to me that it's actually probably a good idea is that Germany is concerned about the U.S. withdrawal of troops.
Dude, I saw that. I did see that.
I said, you got to be shitting me. At one point when I was on the joint staff, so my boss was a military advisor to the Secretary of State, and I used to have to keep a notebook of all the caveats for all the allied forces in Afghanistan. You know, country X had this many people in this many places, but they could only go out between 11 and noon on every Wednesday when there was a full moon. And that was a book that I kept for the Secretary of State when she did her engagements. And if I remember the Germans, they were among the most restricted forces in Afghanistan. I could be wrong, but the idea.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, that Angela Merkel is going to be concerned. And again, 4,500 to 2,500. I have no idea what that means. And all the people that I've seen in the U.S. that are decrying this as being horrible, but they don't tell you what the path to success is. And so we had success in our hands in the fall of, you know, right after 9/11. We had success in our hands.
Define success for me, William.
Success in Afghanistan was we put them all on notice that you do this and you're going to pay. We did a brilliant punitive campaign. We decapitated the people there. We scared the shit out of everyone. And we likely had achieved what we wanted to achieve in Afghanistan, which is never hear the word Afghanistan again. And if we would have had to come back in 10 or 15 years and do it again, so be it. Instead, we dumped $2 trillion into it and have been there for 19 years and have no flipping idea what we're actually trying to achieve. And we had achieved it back then.
The only problem I have with that is the use of the word flippin' on this program. So I just want to tell you that it's something that bothers
me. Yeah, people listen, though.
I forgot.
And I got to tell you something. When we didn't have a show last Thursday, you had some very annoyed listener out there.
Yeah, I told you that, man.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me just tell those shitheads something, okay?
Hey,
I'm not sure who you're talking about, but let me tell.
Who do you think I'm talking about?
I'm talking about his mom.
I didn't mean to call your mom. You know, I never call your mom a shithead. But let me just tell everybody else other than your mom that has that sentiment.
Keith Olbermann now.
Yeah. Hey, quit being so selfish. Sometimes other people have to come first. Okay.
And my mom said that. She said it's not all about me, but
that's why I didn't call your mom a shithead. I called everybody else a shithead who thought that.
She was looking forward to the national anthem, the ring for him, and then favorite guests come on, and then they were not.
Her baby. Right, there she tolerates go. Tim and Jeff. Right, you know what she's trying to. I think it's I think the nation has come to the resolved, conclusion that the best we can do is make them solve their own problem. I mean, what else? What else can we do? It's not going to work out well, But again, unless we want to be there for 60 years and spend a shit ton of money, right, to unfuck this idea that somehow or other we were going to turn this prairie known as Afghanistan into a federal government with a ruling, a strong – I mean, it's just stupid. That OPT – the people involved in that OPT, they need to go to Devil's Island, right, along with some of these other people.
Right. And I would say, Mac, when you say the nation doesn't care.
I know. I'm just saying that those in the nation that do care, I think, are just – they're saying, hey, we're done. That, they got the bowl of water, right? Give me the water, right? And they're doing the Pontius Pilate. We're done with this. We've done the best we can. And I think a lot of people realize what Tim and Jeff had said. And they've said that for years, is that – they will take our money as long as we're willing to send it there. But will they fight for their country? Well, that's a different question. And now we're just going to go back to the gangster chronicles, right? Okay. Next subject. It is the anniversary this week of Tarawa. And Jeff sent that to me in his agenda. So let's talk about that. Jeff? Of all the things in the Tarawa campaign, is there one thing that jumps out at you?
Well, yeah. I mean, since I started really looking at it hard years ago, is Lieutenant William Dean Hawkins. He's the example for the highest example of a Marine lieutenant in an extreme situation. That guy. I mean. Colonel Shoup, later General Shoup, the commandant, said, "It's not often you can credit one guy with winning a battle almost, by himself. But this guy came as close as anybody he'd ever seen." And so the infuriated singleness of purpose of this guy, was infectious, and they needed that because they're in a horrible situation. I got a lot of knowledge about the screw-ups with the Navy and the tides and the reefs and everything like that, the lack of reconnaissance and so forth. But the one of the great things about it is William Dean Hawkins. And people realizing that – and this guy was not a commissioned officer from the get-go. He was commissioned through the ranks. And but
– So hold on. He had a battlefield commission?
Yes. Yeah. He was in a 2nd Marine Regiment. And he had a college degree from the College School of Mines in Colorado or maybe Texas, but he had a degree, when they found that out and the fact that the guy was very motivated, they made him an officer after he was, like I say, he did the whole 2nd Marines thing with them in Guadalcanal. And so Tyro was not his first combat, but he realized, look at the situation, smart guy, he's older than the average First Lieutenant, in that he was like almost 30 years old, and he had a rough life. He was disfigured when he was a child, a baby, like a toddler. His mom accidentally spilled scalding hot water on him when he ran into her apron, and so he had horrible burns over his face and part of his body. And he was a determined kid. His dad died when he was very young. he got himself a scholarship to the School of Mines, got a degree, but it was during the Depression. There's no use for degrees. He was a brakeman on a railroad, which is fighting bums, really, is what that job was, you know, and fighting people who were looking for work, keeping them off the trains and from looting the trains, basically. And so he was a tough guy, you know, and he went there, and he was the first casualty in his platoon. He was the first KA in his platoon, and they had to take the pier. And then there was one, you know, like impossible mission after another given to him, usually directly by Colonel Shoup, you know, or the battalion commanders clustered right there around where the pier met the island of Badio. And so he's my – there's so many heroic stories of Taro, though. But, like, there was Major Ryan, you know, the guy who he ended up taking over, like, a ragtag group of guys on the – if you guys know how – if you remember, and people who might want to look at this, Taro is also noteworthy, and that's barely a mile long. And in some places, you could, like, you could hit a golf ball across it. Well, I couldn't because I can't hit a golf ball. But, like, one of you guys, probably Mac, could probably hit a golf ball across it. But it wasn't very big.
Right. And
the Japanese had almost 5,000 people on it. Every piece of ground, you know, in there was covered by interlocking fields of fire. Unlike, like, Guadalcanal, where they did a lot of heavy fighting, and then they tried the bonsai thing. In Tarawa, it only lasted for 76 hours, but it was brutal. And so this guy Ryan, he got on the short side, short beach, Green Beach, I think. No, Blue Beach.
No, it's Green Beach.
It's Green, yeah, Green Beach. And he got there. He made a little enclave. They had no real comm with Colonel Shoup, who, although he's only a couple hundred yards away, he might as well have been a couple hundred miles away, you know. And eventually they caused enough of a salient for the Japanese. They're able to safely bring in 1st Battalion 6th Marines on rubber boats, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Tom Jones, who was the uncle of our commandant, Jim Jones. So it's just a fascinating battle to me. It's small enough, too, to where it's almost like, remember, me and Timmy used to take the lieutenants to Antietam whenever we could, for a couple of rather unsavory reasons. But one good reason was, it's all right there, you know? It's right. Like you got the sunken road, you got the cornfield, you got the sunken road, and then you got Burnside's Bridge. Well, in Tarawa, it's the same type of thing. It's barely a mile long. You know, I wish I could go there someday, you know, but I can't. But
why not?
It's always been fascinating.
I thought they
me.
Had like that Pacific Battlefield tourist thing that goes to Tarawa. No?
You got to write a letter saying you're loyal to Hillary Clinton to go on that, I think. No, I'm not. I'm just – well, I never know. Maybe I should look at that.
You should.
I have to tell you, though, that first day, there were so many dead bodies because of the screw-ups with the tide and guys having to wade in and being machine-gunned in the surf, that the dead bodies, according to William Manchester, you know, his book Goodbye Darkness, it changed the defilade. It changed the tactics of the thing because of the dead people that were washing up. And to be able to face – that's like the worst nightmare of amphibious – you know, an amphibious attack is a terrorist scenario. And yet these guys weathered through it. So, you know, it's something we should always, like, remember. Because it is – it's like the Marine Corps' first charge of the Light Brigade, so to speak, in World War II. You know, we had Belleau Wood, which is similar suicidal type attack. But, you know, this was our first – you know, it really there was protests against the bloodiness of Marine commanders and so forth to do such a thing. And you had Marines who were home.
Okay,
and,
hold on. Take a fucking breath, okay?
All right.
Just time out.
I can go on for a long time. I
was going to say that, but we all know that. The it's Tarawa Atoll, right? And the island that you're talking about that Hawkins, his actions lead to the Medal of Honor is Basio, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, got it. So, Tim, when you think of Tarawa, what stands out?
You know, the story through history always was is we learned a lot on Tarawa. We made a lot of mistakes that saved a lot of Marines' lives further on in the war. I'm not so sure what exactly the hell those damn lessons were, because the lesson was the preparation was inadequate, and you've got to do something about those in the ground bunkers. And the next operation, come Iwo, instead of 5 days, we get 3 days of prep, and it's the same goddamn thing all over again. So it's that, in a way, it reminds me of Afghanistan, in that we've been there 19 years. There's a lot of lessons to extract out of there that I think will be studiously ignored. But in the future, we'll say, oh, we learned our lesson in Afghanistan, and that's why we're so good at doing whatever the hell it is we're doing. That Tarawa was a bloody fight. It ought not to have been. And it's one of those things where it's hard to imagine being in that kind of a storm of steel. I mean, we've all seen a lot of steel flying around, but nothing like that. And to be like that for 3 days and just trying to push forward, it's amazing that human beings can do it. It's just fucking amazing.
I'll tell you what, I'm looking at it on Google Earth, and Jeff, you can go there if you would like to.
You pay, I'll go.
No, you will pay and you will go. All right. Will, how about you? Your thoughts on Tarawa? Lost connection. There's a problem with the network.
There, I'm here.
Okay. All right. Speak.
Can you hear me?
I can now.
Can you hear me?
Yes. All right. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. But it's enjoyable to hear you yelling like a 90-year-old man.
Get off my lawn!
the toll books have got, I think, a pretty good chapter.
Okay, hold on. How do you spell his name? T-O-A-L, T-O-L-L, T-O-L-L-E? T-O what?
T-O-L-L.
T-O-L-L. All right. The toll books. So.
Yeah. And he's got a pretty good chapter on Tarawa. And I believe that there were lessons there. And
yes.
Other things that are interesting as well is that even with all the backlash, Nimitz, you know, held firm that this is a war and people are going to get hurt. And the idea that we did not anticipate everything there, he wasn't going to hold against senior commanders because some things you just can't see. And so there's that discussion in that book was good. I'll tell you, on my LinkedIn, someone put up about a memorial service that was held, I believe, yesterday for a Marine that was killed in action on November 21st in 1943, and their body was just identified recently, and it was somewhere in Ohio. They held the memorial service for the guy 77 years, either 77 years to the day or 77 years in one day.
And those are the people, and they're the guys, Will, that they're kind of, you know, they're exhuming their bodies at the Punch Bowl in Hawaii, and they're doing DNA stuff on them, and they're identifying them. Or is this guy from Tarawa?
From Tarawa.
From Basio.
From Tarawa.
Okay.
Yeah. Was just exhumed, I want to say, I could look it up, but it was maybe have been over the summer. I think it was before then, but was identified over the summer and laid to rest in the U.S. yesterday.
Wow.
Somewhere in Ohio. I'll pull it up.
Now, yesterday's the anniversary of Hawkins' death.
Yeah.
Now, you know,
how many other countries go to that kind of expense to repatriate remains like we do? That is one of the things that makes me proud when we keep on doing that, by the way.
Oh, no. Yeah. And these families, you see the people that actually go to them. If you read those articles, it's like, my grandma always talked about how it impacted my mom, her mom and dad, to never have his remains returned. You know, that we never had the closure of having a ceremony or anything. That was never anything we could go visit, and how and how hard that was on the family. And you know, they talk about, you know, why, you know, normally these things are pretty well attended, and how good it makes them feel, and they just, there's the sadness they feel that, you know, I wish my mom and dad could be here today, because, you know, it was devastating for them to never have a, you know, a never had something they could bury, a place that they could go visit, and whatnot. So no, those are, I agree with you, Timmy. I think it's and I'll tell you what, if you're ever around that stuff, again, I mean, I say this all the time, but do not get the nightly news confused with the country that you live in. I mean, this country,
no kidding.
Right? This country has incredible people in it that honestly do give a shit. And, you know, when something like this happens, you get a chance to meet them. And it's that goodness that I think is very motivating. But I agree with you, Timmy.
Yeah, this guy was PFC Frank Leroy Athon. And was laid to rest on the 21st of November in Withamsville, Ohio. Was killed in action November 22nd, 1943.
Hmm. Amazing.
If I dig around a little more, find out when he was identified. But it's been a little while.
Right. Right. No, that's not a short process to do all that and to make sure everything's right and whatnot. And they don't have stuff from everybody, right, in their DNA archives. They have stuff from a fair number of people. I've read some stuff on them before. It's pretty fascinating the way they do that. And then, you know, they go ask relatives for DNA samples, and that's how they match this stuff, if they can find, you know, a good bit of DNA. So I'd be curious to know where they, because if you look at an aerial shot of Bacio Island today, it's a populated, you know, it's wall to wall people, wall to wall structures. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I
didn't know that.
Yeah, neither did I. I Google Earthed it, and you know, the one thing you can't see, I wish, you know, years ago, you know, we would have had this, because you can see, you know, you could see why the beaches off to the west, you know, made sense, right? Because they, you know, they were deeper draft beaches, and then you could see the lagoon, right? You could see the shallowness of it, and why the, you know, why the huge challenge there, and and whatnot. You know, to me, I mean, General Shout's first, you know, he makes his huge debut that day.
Yeah, 37-year-old lieutenant colonel.
Yeah, right.
Lieutenant colonel.
Right, and his quote is, you know, I mean, it's part of Marine Corps lore, and then I remember when my son Patrick was commissioned. In the National Museum of the Marine Corps. And so, and this is a selfish, thing to say, but, I was so happy because, you know, here's my youngest son, and you're in the Cathedral of the Marine Corps, and, you look up and you see, you know, Colonel, is it Shoup or Shoup?
Shoup.
You see his quote, and you're sitting in here. I was standing there. One of my sons, a lieutenant, the other one's getting commissioned, and Dave Furness is commissioning my son. Chris Bronzy's there, and it's just like a great day. And I remember looking up and reading his quote, and thinking, you know, just what an awesome day. But it's his debut, and the thing, and we've talked about this since this, and we talked about descent as a general officer. One of the things that is unique about General Shoup is his criticism of the war in Vietnam, and he was ostracized and badmouthed because he stood up and told the truth, and he's a very interesting guy. But this is his. If you read a little, this is a little paragraph. In mid-1943, Shoup was transferred from the staff of Major General Julian C. Smith, commander of the 2nd Marine Division, and tasked to help plan the invasion of Baisho on Tarawa Atoll. Shoup's aggressive leadership style would complement the offensive strategy his superiors were seeking in taking the atoll. He was tasked with drawing up the initial plans designating the landing beaches on Baisho for the 2nd Marine Division, overseeing some of the rehearsals at Efate, E-F-A-T-E. However, after Colonel William Marshall, commander of the 2nd Marines, suffered a nervous breakdown before the invasion, Smith promoted Shoup to colonel, gave him command of the regiment in spite of Shoup's lack of combat experience. How about that? Yep. That's awesome.
Hey, let me tell you one other thing about Shoup and that planning thing. Shoup was so thorough that he looked at aerial photographs and he identified the latrines that the Japanese had set up. And they had three types of latrines. They had officer latrines, enlisted latrines, and Korean worker latrines. So doing the math and figuring about you know, the ratios and the way the Japanese culture was, he came within like 200 bodies of accurate count of enemy forces on Baisho.
Based on shitter?
Based on the shitter. Yeah.
Shitter analysis?
Yes. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And then he said, we got to be prepared to chase the Japanese down the atoll because you can wade from one little island to another. Like, for instance, they had 2-6 chase the remnants of the Japanese all the way to the end of the atoll, which is the island of Bariki, and wipe them out.
Right.
Like 3 days, 3 or 4 days later, yeah.
So if you're looking at Baisho, the long flat side, you know, is you're staring at that, right? The mm-hmm. deep draft landing beaches are to the left, and then the pier is on the far side of the island, extending, you know, to the north. If you look at that, the attack comes from the left and from the far side of the island, and then, you know, gets ashore, and they both head, you know, to the right side of the map. And that atoll, as Jeff said, I mean, when you look at it, that you can drive, you know, that atoll, you can, it's kind of an inverted, well, it's a C, it's an inverted C, and you can drive that thing. So absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Something else too, like that's the Gilbert Islands, and the big island, the most, you know, I guess valuable island in the Gilberts was Macon Island, which was the target of the raid. Right. And as Will will tell you from reading the toll books, it's also a target for a lot of Halsey's early carrier raids, you know, Macon Island, and you know, the Japanese you know, forces there and so forth. So
and Tarawa's significance is
it was long enough to put a good airfield on it.
Yeah, the Japanese had an airfield on it.
Right, and the but Macon Island, an army unit was trying to take that, and they were dawdling. The army's philosophy was everybody moves forward at once. You know, we make sure that all our artillery is online. Whereas the Marines, as we know, have a tendency to lunge at the enemy wherever there's a gap, you exploit it and so forth, and it's reckless. But the fact is that there's a certain portion of the Navy that has to just sit there, kind of like a helicopter hovering, you know, over a medevac, or, you know, or something like that, or over a fast rope, you know, in order for you guys to be able to prosecute operations ashore. And while they were screwing around on Macon Island, I can't remember which regiment it was, a regiment of, I think, of the 27th Division, which later had problems with on Saipan with General Hyland S. Smith. Right. But anyway, that ship, one of the major transports, was sunk by Japanese torpedoes from the island. And I think they lost more people in the water there, the Navy did, than we did at Tarawa in 76 hours of fighting.
Well, Will, you were going to look something up, yes? Or no?
No, I found it. It's the guy's name, Athon.
Got it.
The guy that was killed in action. And I was reading a little bit. I think he got identified in 2019, I believe.
Got it.
So it took a while to get it fully confirmed, identified, and then have his remains put together and brought home.
Got it. Timmy, any other thoughts or comments about Tarawa?
Well, the you know, that was
It was not the premier, I think, but it was one of the very first operations by the UDTs, the underwater demolition teams, who were the forerunners of the SEALs. And I think on D+3, as they were just getting things kind of organized, the Admiral Turner had tasked the SEALs, the UDT teams, to blow a channel into that, you know, into that big ass lagoon there. And they did. They spent a day packing TNT, and they backed all the boats out of it. But when they blew it, it caused like a tsunami that almost capsized Turner's boat. It was apparently quite the drama, because they knew it would go sideways through the lagoon, but then it just all came, you know, went and it hit the shore, then it bounced back, and then it came shooting out the mouth into the bay and damn near capsized some boats. But that's a that. Which is exactly what you'd think was a perfect start to the SEALs. It was absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, not talking shit about it. Those guys did a good job there. They did a good job on Okinawa and Iwo Jima after that. But the
police. Well, hey, I'll tell you what. If you want to read something interesting on Iwo Jima, read about the reconnaissance that took place on the 18th before they went ashore. Yeah, I mean, those guys got the shit blasted out of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, those guys were ballsy, man. But they were just as good with the explosive calculations as the guys today. I read that, it was hooting and hollering at that one. That must have been a sight to see.
Oh my God! You could just see the look on everybody's faces when it starts to go the wrong way.
The battle also leads to one of the great mottos, of course, you know, the motto of the Second Marines: keep moving. You know,
I thought it was follow. Oh, Second Marines, not Second Marine Regiment.
Second Marine Regiment. Yeah. Keep moving.
Got it. The other thing is that, the Marine Corps had, unlike the other branches of the service, had more cameras and, you know, combat camera and combat correspondence, and then that video that Marines take ultimately becomes, you know, pretty controversial thing. But it is the Marine Corps' effort to chronicle its achievements in the Pacific that begins really a legacy of, you know, Marine Corps combat camera, you know, Marines. You know, have always been everywhere, and they've always been a big part of telling the Marine story. But they first really, I think, break squelch on Tarawa, you know, and their work is pretty controversial. And so, but yeah, they are there. I mean, you could still, I mean, Jeff talked about Lieutenant Hawkins. I mean, those pictures and that video of the flamethrowers working on those pillboxes on that big fucking hill. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've all seen that stuff. I mean, you know, forever with the images and the videos of it. It has no, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I say in post-traumatic winning about leadership is like, look, you know, the Marine Corps is one of the most flawed branches of service. The reason we win is relentlessness. The human DNA that walks through, that isn't afraid of a challenge of our recruit training, you know, and wants to be part of this team. You know, combined with the relentless spirit of it, you know, and I don't know that it's ever on greater display than on Tarawa, wading ashore into crew-served weapons, and it brings to mind something I remember reading in Afghanistan. The EW guys intercepted, and it was just kind of this intel assessment of, you know, so many Marines moving into the province, and it was. These Marines believe themselves to be the fanatical fighters of the United States. They have it's hilarious reading it, right? It was, they have a long lineage that goes back to before the Second World War. If you shoot machine guns at them, they will not run. They will run towards the machine gun. Be very careful. These are not typical American troops. And reading it was hilarious.
You should have seen what they're saying about the British, too. That's so funny. Because the British, all they're talking about was my wand.
Yeah. Yeah, right. From the Second Afghan War, yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
But it was funny to read that. But, you know, we begin to write that legacy. I mean, when you see – I just talked about pictures of, you know, of the flamethrower and where Lieutenant Hawkins, you know, the area that he wins his Medal of Honor. There's also incredible footage of wading ashore in that lagoon. And you look at that and you think, you know, good God, can you imagine? Get out, boys, let's go. And going, and guys are dying, and you're trying to save them, and that kind of shit experience. And that's just to get ashore. Then you got, then we got to fight once we get there. And so,
I mean, Hawkins' mission was to take that pier, because it could have been even worse as it horribly was, because the Japanese had machine guns in the pier, in the rocks, in the jetty-like area there, that would enfilade, hit these guys, you know, from the right as they're coming in towards the beach, where there's a storm of fire already. The legend has it that some of the guns from Singapore that the Japanese captured from the British were out there, you know? And so Hawkins guys landed there, him in the lead, landed there on the end of the pier, Max, just like you said, and burned and blasted their way all the way down it pretty quick. So that was, you know, integral to the thing.
No, it's humbling. And I've spent a little bit of time with the 2nd Marine Division over the course of the last 2 years. And have been there on a couple of occasions when they celebrate these anniversaries, and it's pretty cool, you know, it's pretty cool to hear them talk about, you know, their own legacies and button popping proud that, you know, you walk in the footsteps of guys who hopped out of those boats and into the water, you know, got ashore and then sucked it up and got after them. It's amazing. It's an amazing battle. Jeff, I don't know as much about Tarawa as I do about Iwo Jima. And Will, you and Tim, give me a one lesson learned out of Tarawa. Well, Jeff,
that's a good question.
Thank you.
I guess the lesson learned out of Tarawa is the Marines should be prepared all the time, prepared to deal with, a disastrous turn of events, and to continue, though, to keep focused on the mission. Because to be let off your Higgins boat in 11 feet of water, where you're loaded down with gear, and then to be slaughtered, you know, once you do manage to get ground high enough to where you can wade in, and yet still continue to have the offensive spirit, and like those guys in Ryan's people there in the Green Beach and so forth is I'm talking, this is a moral thing, you know what I mean, that you should drill, the Marines should, they should never lose that attitude, you know, because that's I mean, there's a lot of lessons about amphibious reconnaissance and naval gunfire and so forth that were pretty much, they were learned pretty good at Tarawa. I'm not talking about that, though. I'm talking about when disaster strikes, you know, how do you deal with it? You know, you don't just always abort and try again. I'll tell you right now, most of SOCOM, if things start to go wrong, the plan is abort, you know? I mean, I don't want to oversimplify things, but with the Marine Corps, should never be always your first instinct is quit and start again maybe later. You know, no, you got to try to make oatmeal, or you know, you got to try to make an omelet out of these busted eggs, you know.
Well, you know, I think,
and it's horrifying, you know.
Special Operations Command has the luxury to do that, right? But everybody once you get it all pointed there, it's like, we can't take them out. We don't have the ass to take them out. All those assets are doing other things, so it's interesting. Will, lesson learned?
Yeah, it hard to follow that. And that is a great lesson, you know, the Marine Corps, and that moral force matters. I think the lesson they learned is you can never have too many Amtraks. Because even all the ones you need to get to people to the beach, you're going to need more than that to get people back and forth.
Yes.
I mean, we were short simply because we couldn't manufacture them at that point. But I think later in the war, they did a good job of taking whatever the estimate was, multiplying it by four, and then adding a little.
And so,
yeah, that's true.
So just so everybody understands,
a bit to it.
Talk about Jeff. Can you talk about the Higgins you know, the issue with with the reef, the Higgins boats, and the tractors. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the Higgins boat is a preferred method to get troops from shipping to shore because you could put in whole units intact, you know, with like in a Higgins boat. You guys all saw Saving Private Ryan. Starts out with the Higgins boat going into Omaha Beach, but the truth of it was, and this was really brought home at Tarawa, and Will really hits on it. The tides and the topography, the hydrography of the beach here is just too variable. So you need that something like an amphibious assault vehicle, which in those days they call an LVT. And so that science, you know, led to ultimately the P-7 and the C-7, you know, AAVs, the AAV-7 that we've been using now since 1972. Right. And if they had that then.
But on Tarawa, it's there, but it's in small numbers, yes?
It's just, yes. Yeah, you can only put one regiment. Actually, only two battalions in AAVs.
Right.
Because of the hydrography of the Tarawa Lagoon, there's high coral ridges with only like 6 inches of clearance at certain times. There's no way the Higgins boat could clear that, you know, so they had to dump those guys out there. A shitload of them drowned. The rest of them were wading in under fire. It was terrible. The AAV guys were able to get, you know, in the water across the, you know, the coral reef there, but they got hit point blank by, you know, direct fire. We're talking 5 and 7 inch guns, blown to bits a lot of times.
Right.
But enough of them made it to the beach, to where you had like 2-6 and other units like that were almost intact when they hit the beach, you know, up by the seawall.
Right. Which was important because at that point the Japanese have to focus on them and then take some pressure off the guys that are still in the water and dealing with that show. Timmy, any other points relative to Tarawa?
Yeah, the Tarawa, the inadequacy of the preparation bombardment was vexing, and there was and it was even more vexing because on Basio you've got no reverse slopes. The naval gunfire and Marines realize that in the future we can't even silence dug-in artillery on forward slopes, on flat ground. What are we going to do with reverse slopes? And so they started at least trying to develop methods that would deliver indirect fire on reverse slopes, as well as how the hell are we going to tackle these fortified positions? And so by the time you get into, I think it's by Guam or Tinian, you're using napalm to burn away camouflage and vegetation, and then concentrated salvos to knock cliff faces out to expose the concrete embedments, and then they start attacking those, which is what they're doing by Iwo Jima time frame. So that's how sophisticated that got, but I don't believe they ever had a satisfactory answer for indirect fire on the way into the landing beach, because I know that they tried to come up with lashing together crap on Higgins boats and LVTs, and they ended up capsizing them and lost a bunch of Marines in heavy seas towing that shit, trying to work with it in the beaches.
Got it. Yeah. All right. What are we reading? Will, you can go first because Jeff can't copy what you're reading unless he sinks to an all time fucking low. Go ahead, Will.
So. I finished that book on Philip and Alexander. Good book. Very good narrative to it. I would recommend it. And it was, I think it's called Philip and Alexander by, I want to say Goldsworthy. And then since I've been on quarantine, I read a book by a guy named Thomas Fleming about Lexington and Concord. It's called First Stroke.
Yeah.
And I've read books about Lexington and Concord, but this was very concise and much more detailed. And so another – he's a good author about Revolutionary War era type things. And now I'm reading a book by a guy named Eric Felt, F-E-L-D-T. It's The Coast Watchers. And this is a really great story. you know, we associate Coast Watchers with like Martin Clemens on Guadalcanal.
Yes.
But this goes into a lot more about how widespread the Coast Watchers were and how they were supported by Catalina boats dropping things off and submarines, and how they attempted to.
Hey, Will.
Go ahead.
Explain to everybody what a Catalina boat is.
Amphibious aircraft can take off and land on the water. Big boats with long range.
PBY was their designation, yes?
Right. So they used them for reconnaissance, mostly fleet reconnaissance at great range. And I don't know the numbers, but longest range, I think, of any aircraft maybe outside of B-17s. Yeah. That we had.
Yeah, so it landed on the water. They were like the cod service around the Pacific before there was such a thing as cod service flying around.
Yeah.
You'll see pictures of them. You know, that's how the Navy got people around, and they were a very versatile and useful little asset there in the Pacific.
But this the book on the Coast Watchers, it goes into how they tried to get the natives on their side, and just a lot of phenomenal stories about, you know, people holed up in these islands reporting Japanese movement, how key it was to the defense of Henderson Field, their ability to give warning on Japanese, but all through the Solomons campaign. So had never somehow this book came up in my feed, and I got it on Kindle, and a really good book. And this guy Eric Felt was apparently like in charge of all the Coast Watchers for a significant part of time up through at least 1944. I haven't finished the book yet, so that's what I got.
Got it. All right, Timmy, what are you reading?
Well, since we missed last week, I did finish the toll book on the Pacific, and I wanted to note it's interesting how as the war was winding down, Japan was making serious efforts to try to get a peace deal from us by working through their ambassador in Russia, and they were operating under the assumption that the Russians were treating them like fair international clients on the up and up. And all Russia was doing, Russia did not sign the Potsdam Agreement, and the Japanese were saying, see, they're with us, they're going to negotiate, they're going to bring this to an end. And all the Russians were doing is playing them along for 3 months until he finally calls the ambassador in and gives him a declaration of war. That's what Molotov, the foreign minister, does. And I just can't help but think of listening to Grant describe how our relationship with China was in the past. I just leave that for your information, because this week, at the suggestion of my father, by the way, so from the general himself, The Last Winter of the Weimar Republic. This is a German book translated into English sort of well by two authors, Barth and Fredericks, and it covers the 1st of November 1932 to the 30th of January 1933, and it's how a republic became a dictatorship, how that exactly happened. And it's kind of interesting, although it's difficult because, you know, my dad was a German speaker as a kid, and he might read, because you're reading direct German translation, so sentence structure isn't the same. It's kind of difficult, but it's interesting how Hitler pulled that crap off. Not exactly as easy as I thought.
Got it. Jeff, what are you reading?
Well, a couple comments first on Tim, what Tim said. Tim's dad is one of the best guys to he wrote a thing to Timmy that Tim shared with us at IOC, I think after you left, Mac. But it was about weird stuff that happens with commandants. You remember that, Tim?
Yeah, I do.
And he had some pretty good dirt on General Shoup.
Oh, he had some excellent dirt. It was funny.
Yeah. So, but it's like, it was just, you know, again, it was. And then what I'm reading now, this is going to make you happy, Mac, because I'm reading that toll thing that Will recommended. I mean, Will's been recommending books to me. I think the first book he ever recommended to me was The Fatal Shore by Thomas Hughes, which I read on our first float, trying trying to hold on to my lunch crossing the Atlantic in that LST for the first time. And but I learned in that book, Fatal Shore, that Captain Bly, who was the mutiny guy whose crew mutinied on him, became the governor of Australia, and they the whole continent mutinied on him there. So, you know, so that was interesting. But right now I am reading the toll book, the first toll book. And that's where I got, you know, I'm at the part where Halsey had just finished his preliminary raids against the Gilberts and some of the others. And they lucked out in not getting hit, you know, as hard as they might. The Enterprise and the Hornet. Very interesting. And another interesting tidbit, I just finished reading this part where he sails into Pearl Harbor. And there's like a gauntlet of destroyers that they sail the carriers into. And he makes the guys all wear their whites and man the rails when they come in. And everybody's clanging their horns and making more out of the raid than it really was. And Nimitz says to him, you know, great job, great job, Bill. And Halsey's an emotional guy. He bursts into tears, you know. It's an interesting read, you know. The other book I'm reading this book by Hamilton Sides, the guy who wrote On Desperate Ground, about Kit Carson. That's just great, too.
I thought it was Hampton Sides.
Hampton Sides. I'm sorry. Yeah. Hamilton Sides.
This is his brother. He's a wrestler.
Fire and Thunder. That's the name of the book, yeah. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
It's awesome. It's awesome.
Yeah. Book. And it's great. And it's like, you know, the dawn of our country, really. Basically, how we, you know, became the coast-to-coast nation we are through the experiences of this one incredible guy, Kit Carson. So I'm reading that. Those are the two I'm reading.
Got it.
And they're good. You should all read it.
What happens to General Shoup after the Tarawa campaign?
Well, he becomes a general and eventually becomes our commandant.
No, he doesn't. He becomes directly after it, in the aftermath. He becomes the chief of staff, 2nd Marine Division.
Right. Okay.
Then he becomes a staff officer. And he makes the landings on Saipan and Tinian. He gets trapped with a fellow officer, Wallace M. Green. And Green later recalls, Shoup was pretty calm under pressure.
Yeah, right.
And Shoup's probably thinking, this ain't shit compared to that peer, for God's sakes.
And he was a movie star.
Yeah.
In
the sands of Iwo Jima.
As himself.
And returned to the United States in October of 19, so less than a year after he does Tarawa, he returns to the United States, and he is a logistics officer in the divisions of plans and policies at Headquarters Marine Corps because of his background as a planner, and remains there for the rest of the war. So that's
and as a and as a commode analyst.
Exactly. A refined the science of commode estimates. So anyway. Well, one more question I wanted to kind of get to. Growing up, how would you spend Thanksgiving? What was do you guys have a big family? Were they all big family events? Tell me about. Jeez, who is that?
It is not Tim.
I know.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I don't know what Jeff does, but the microphone goes. No, you do something. I don't know what you do. I don't know if you start eating as soon as you stop talking. I don't know what it is, but all of a sudden, all kinds of crazy shit comes out of your microphone. Anyway, William, tell us about Thanksgiving at the Costantini home. When you were a kid.
Yeah, almost always we would go down to my grandmother's house in Brooklyn, and it'd be a big family Thanksgiving. My grandmother lived in a house that it's like two apartments, one on top of each other. So she lived on the ground floor. My grandfather passed away in the 70s. But my aunt, uncle, three cousins lived upstairs. My grandmother's sister, so my great aunt, and my great uncle lived three blocks away. Had one of my grandfather's sisters lived two blocks away, so another great aunt. My brothers or my dad's brother lived there sometime, but then lived in the city. So, yeah, it was just a massive family Thanksgiving, that, you know, like 14 courses, you know, and they rolled the turkey out, you'd been full for 3 hours already, and it extended well after that. I think that we used to start at about halftime of the first football game and collapse sometime in the fourth quarter of the second football game. So that was, that's Thanksgiving when I was a kid in particular.
Now,
I was down there.
Which side of the family is that? Is that your mom's side or your dad?
My dad's side. My dad, born and raised in Brooklyn.
Got it. Timmy, how about you? Thanksgiving growing up in the Lynch household?
Well, we would two of my three uncles were also Marines. So whenever any of the families were on the same coast or in the same general area, we would all get together and have a big ass Thanksgiving meal. So I would say about maybe half the Thanksgivings I was growing up, we would have my cousins over. Otherwise, it would just be my family, and it was a big deal. I mean, my mother was a great cook. She took a lot of pride in that. We'd have a big old turkey meal and watch football and all that other kind of good stuff like everybody else did. That, stuff I don't do anymore, as a matter of fact, watching football. Jesus. But, yeah, that was good memories about Thanksgiving for sure growing up.
Right. Jeff, how about you? Did the Pasquales come over and have Thanksgiving or what?
No, we went to my grandmother's De Pasquale's house, and there's 11 of them, and count my mom. And at first, we'd switch back. Sometimes we'd go to the Kennys, but eventually, my dad's brothers and sisters would take their families to the Pasquale Thanksgiving, because it was a massive undertaking, you know, with several turkeys and hams and shit like that. A lot of arguing, and, you know, we played basketball out in the – she had a garage basketball thing set up, like, I think in 1952 or something by my uncles. But so it was good. It was a great time. A lot of chow, you know, a lot of people. Only thing that dwarfed it was Christmas.
Yeah, we would spend it with my grandmother and grandfather, who moved to Sacramento where my dad lived. And they were – my grandfather, originally from Michigan, moved to Alaska and was a bookkeeper in the mines up there and meets my grandmother. Anyway, my grandma and grandpa ultimately moved down to Sacramento. But my mother, you know, like Timmy was saying, my mother was, you know, I mean, I think like all of our moms, I mean, she took great pride in Thanksgiving. And my mom was an incredible cook, and the food was just awesome. And, you know, it was, you know, sitting around. I think it's why it's my favorite, right? Yeah, you watch football, you hang out, you're with your family, and you eat. So it's pretty, I think, as holidays go. But my mom, it was, you know, it was one of the great days. And she loved, you know, that the kitchen was the center of the event. And she took great pride in it. And so it was pretty cool. So anyway, all right, boys. Well, first of all, thanks for doing this. And, to all of our fans, I apologize for last week, but just so you know, I was down doing post-traumatic winning in the morning and the evening, and I didn't even have the time to come home and record anything with these guys. And then ultimately though, got to have lunch with Jeff on Friday. So that was nice. And a friend of ours, Ted Greeley. So very nice to be able to spend some time in person with Jeffrey. All right. Have a great day.
I was at my best that day.
have a great Thanksgiving, man.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving, yeah. Guys. Hey, Thanksgiving. Hey, Will, good luck.
Keep your powder dry.
More of Auburn Radio coming up next.